and Power Politics in Swamp Town, Yo, by Nina Galen, read by the author. Crocamama. Tranquility reigned in Swamp Town, Yo, population 209. Crocamama waited in a long, wavy line to pay her water tax, clasping a handbag fabricated from the well-tanned hide of that Yorkshire terrier who never denied he'd found it scarier trying to swim with four big teeth sunk into him than not. His supple, hirsute skin now filled with gold doubloons, formal legal tender in some tough, perhaps illegal double dealings of long-dead Spanish merchants. Coin recently sucked from the rank crustacean muck of a sunken wreck by Martin Searles, the charming treasure-seeker, whose million-dollar hunch resulted in, oh God, no, quite a sodden bunch of pockets stuffed with coin and misdirected crabs. And aren't those pearls that were his eyes? She'd joined that day for lunch. And feeling just fine, Crocamama was, now that Rockadile, her lazy, accident-prone son, struck last Friday by a 2-ton truck on Interstate 95 and nearly road-killed, still alive but 6 days in a coma. Maybe now, the Lord be praised, he'd change his wicked ways and act more like he oughter, stop jaywalking, scaring tourists off, and wasting water. Young Crocodile awakened from his coma and found himself surrounded by ecologists, folk who shyly, then with greater zeal, squeeze-dried his tail, admired his sutures, offered him a chance at 7 different eco-futures, 3 archival, 4 in native dance. He, while saying nothing personally, preferred consorting with a certain alligator bird, lying in the sun with her on top, pecking parasites and tickling his hide. Yes, when Rockadile awoke from his long coma, realized he had nearly died, quickly checked out his persona and found it, praise the Lord, still stuffed with soul, his first words were, let the good times roll. Rockefeller. Crocafeller, sitting on his hillock, studied his reflection in his private pool, drew back his lips, wrinkled up his snout, and seeing he was getting longer in the tooth, stuck his tongue out at his wrinkled image. Ha! Only yesterday had he been challenged to a pecking order scrimmage by some macho whippersnapper. No problemo. He was still top croc and would remain so. Boss of Swamp Town and all Southern Yo, he'd sent that poor swain packing. For you see, a croc as top as he had no need himself to tussle, could instead call in some hired muscle, as Crocafeller always did, when needing to protect his hustle. But on this date, more urgent business filled his plate. Like whom to hire? What charismatic, brain-dead crocoliar as Congressional Committee expert witness to fulminate against each piece of pro-environmental legislation that might endanger all the perfectly regressive tolls, taxations, and assessments that he personally levied on inhabitants of every marsh and morass, bog, ditch, dike, and shoal within his purview and control? Who send to Washington to advocate his cause? His eye, of course, was on young Rock, exactly the right croc to play the prince to Crocafeller's Machiavelli, one problem being unconfirmed reports that some conservation wonks imagined Rockadile to be a new god king, an avatar of sorts, a Crocodile Lama of the region's underbelly. This discovery, inspired by young Rockadile's miraculous recovery from coma and the length, strength, and potential flick of his prodigious tail, appeared to make him qualified to rule. Plus, there was the finding of auspicious flotsam in his stool when he was sick, stuff rumored to be grail and scepter and guitar pick. Well, old Crocafeller'd see about that mumbo-jumbo, knowing as he did what no one else did know, that he was Rocky's deadbeat dad, deserted him a dozen years ago when Rock was just a tad. Nor had he ever told the Crocamother, who still believed, for her to have achieved an offspring so recessive, she must have mated with her brother. Resting on her chin, Crocodile watched the last squad car drive off, silent as a hearse. It wasn't often that a single-engine plane, tired of the sky and thinking incorrectly, it could land on muck or worse without much sinking, gave it such a try. Dolly, second of the first 5 reptiles to arrive, never reckoned as she raced across the bog she'd be in time to see 3 faces through the plexi, 2 human and 1 dog, all looking scared but very much alive. Until came Rockadile, lured from lazing in the sun with his close chum, an alligator bird, to crack the cockpit with his jaws as easily as crunching crayfish claws and pull the white meat out. Her share, following the croco frenzy, one pair of ladies' lips bent in a smile, or were they upside down and meant to be a frown, plus half an arm, a hand with ring finger intact, but minus its gold band, that crocodile. Her dopey meal got crocodile-y thinking how thick and dark the waters thereabout were getting, swamps and bogs all stinking of decay, fish and frogs so hard to find that crocs were forced to ruminate on dogs and humankind. The blame, of course, lay at the feet of Crockefeller, slime-lord don of half the croco-mafioso in the county and beyond, well-connected in D.C., with legislators dancing to the tunes of crocs and alligators bearing gold doubloons, not to mention well-paid lobbyists most willing to bear false witness, favoring, of course, big business, against the better interests of their kind. Crocodile sighed. What Swamptown needed was a democratically elected croco hero, not some fella seeking private gain, nor prone at any moment to be struck by two-ton truck or gravy train. And then an idea came. A U.S. Senate seat for Yo was up for grabs. Why should it go without a struggle to some Crockefeller stooge? One thing was clear. If she did try to win it, and didn't put her whole heart in it, he'd nail her in a minute, using big bucks, lies, and subterfuge. Fell in love. That wedding band he found he gave to his dear alligator bird, who made no fuss, sought no commitment, not even once referred to us, just wore it on her left foot like a trooper. And that was fine. Yes, that was super, yet there was, it seems, another matter, a vision that appeared in all his recent dreams, a certain snout, two eyes that prettily stuck out above the waterline, a certain tail, with more to him somehow than any scepter, pick, or grail. Her name was Crocodile. Crocodile. Just to hear it spoken made him feel his life was broken and the glue was crocodile, made him feel like he'd been flattened by a trolley named Desire, helpless railroad kill with loins eternally on fire. How constantly since then, day in, day out, did Crocodile recall that lovely snout, the way she'd chewed upon that hand, which he had stupidly unbanded, how she ate that smile, or frown, just managing to keep it down, then wasted no time with that arm, preferring food that still was warm. And now had come old Crockefeller's message, an offer that did presage quite a change in Rocky's lifestyle, at the very least a metamorphosis from lazy lout to senator from Yo, plus the customary move to Washington, D.C. This being so, it shouldn't show, Rock felt, a lack of cool, or be considered cruel, to ask the alligator bird to give his ring back. Ack, oh no, on doing so he learned, in no uncertain terms, that she no longer had it. Oh? And when dismayed, he blurted out, "How could you let my ring go?" The bird replied inscrutably, "Go stuff a pink flamingo." Old Hillock. When old Crockefeller summoned Rocky to his hillock and ordered up a vat of crayfish from his private cellar, he learned his guest just wasn't hungry, hadn't eaten since the feeding frenzy following the plane disaster, had no idea how long his fast would last or just what ailed him. "I like you, boy," old Crockefeller told him, flipped a crayfish in the air and nailed him as he fell, "but you gotta be in good condition. Truth to tell, you're just the croc to beat the competition." "Like who?" asked Rock, who really didn't care until he heard the name, heard Crocodile floating on the air. Then he went pale, his legs gave out, and he collapsed on belly, tail, and snout. And there he lay, his mind awhirl, while Crockefeller talked the afternoon away about the Crocopotty and its mission to end big government, its taxes and restrictions, such as eliminating trade in threatened reptile skins. And then, to build a fire in the young croc's belly, he quoted Machiavelli, who said that politics and virtue need not mix, that in political arenas any means is justified to grab and then hang on to power. And so he talked on hour after hour, explaining how Republicans, while in debates with opposition candidates, might make this point, that separating politics from morals did equate with separating church and state, an idea Demodiles themselves did advocate. Ms. Crocodile's views, old Crockefeller sighed, are easy to deride, but not so easy to debate, which is why it's fortunate I founded, own, and run a tabloid called the Crocodile Sun, which will always take your side when you two tussle on the stump. We will, said Rock, whose heart went thump. You'll find she makes her loudest racket on questions ecological, and every argument you make, she will attack it. Think you can hack it? Piece of cake, young Rock assured him. No problemo. Beautiful, said Crockefeller, who, right then and there, put foot on heart to solemnly declare, come water high or water low, I'll make you senator from Yo, and off to Washington you'll go to undermine with every vote you cast the power of the government to tax, plus find a way to sabotage each ruling that subsidizes conservation or preschooling. And if you do your part and play it smart, the public will grow so cynical that at the pinnacle of their despair, they'll cease to vote or even care. And then you'll note the Oval Office and the Capitol Rotunda will weaken, topple, tear asunder, and as loud as thunder fall and crush a century of jurisprudence, social programs, labor unions. And when the dust has cleared, you'll see that power has returned to ordinary folk like you and me to leave us free to get as rich can be. You're on, said Rock, I'll run. It sounds like fun. And then he learned that he was Crockefeller's son and that the hillock and the pool were his to share. Go take a dip, old Crockefeller said. You're pretty muddy. And then we'll have some catfish pie. And then we'll study. Vival. It was a vision. It was a din. 427 crocs, all freshly catechized, rebaptized, and free of sin, tromped muddily toward ye old revival meeting, first ever of a to-be annually held and re-held righteous reveling in downtown Swamptown. On they slogged, all bellowing their tribal greeting, hollering their love of the almighty, merciful, all-knowing Croco-spirit, according to the gospel of Horatio Crockefeller. Hour after hour, Croco-legions swarmed out swamps and gullies, flowed through sewers, drains, and tunnels, over viaducts and bridges, cramming access roads and highways, jamming five-way intersections, ditto driveways far and near, seen even by the cosmonauts on Mir. Great thighs a-swishing, tails a-lashing, slathering the muck in all directions, till each crocodile was coated snout to bum. Croco hullabaloo, shouted headlines in the sun, for weeks to come. Crockefeller's Reverie. Super-duper, sneered old Crockefeller, watching from his hillock. Swamptown's crocs in hardly any time had more than doubled population 209. It was clear his pro-life teachings, moral preachings that forbade the eating of all newly hatched and barely viable, albeit toothsome, crocodilian young, touted piously and often in his crocodile son, had paid off 2-1. For, by so increasing population, Crockefeller had more than doubled what he brought in through extortion, taxation, and increased twofold his tabloid circulation, not to mention filled his bins with luxury-grade reptile skins. Indeed, for every Swamptown bro who opted not to be a sinner and spared a baby croc targeted to be his dinner, he, Crockefeller, was a big-time winner. Just look at them, he chuckled, all so happy to be hatched into this blighted world, all praising me, the master spoiler, envying my business smarts, those crocs with muddy snouts and naive hearts, who hardly even notice that their water isn't clean, indeed that almost nothing can be seen beneath the surfaces of bogs and bayous. Crockefeller grinned. These fools would never know how he had sinned, that he, the town supplier, to make the situation dire, and send the price of water higher, had shut off half the flow 2 weeks ago. Mama's Misgivings. Crocomama got there early, as mothers of grown children can, climbed the bleachers, stretched her 7 meters on a bench, readjusted 5, and waited for the preachers, Pauls, and faithful to arrive. Soon she heard what sounded like an alligator bird, then dozens more, until there were 1,000 pipings, whistlings, and gripings of a displaced flock. And underlying all this noise, the oft-repeated shock of foot on earth, a mighty tromping, bellowing, and stomping, as 427 crocs converged on downtown Swamptown. How they thundered! How the earth did quake! From fear, she wondered, fear that ground might break, collapse right in, and shake right down those walls, both perpendicular and round, that made the alleys and the tunnels of the town. One thing was certain, with their ecosystem and their infrastructure threatened, it was high time Swamptown sent an eco-croc to Washington. Not Rock by any means, her son was no politico, nor should he be, though it was rumored that old Crockefeller, dotty leader of the right-wing Crocco Party, a.k.a. Republican or COP, had his eye on her son Rocky for some job or candidacy. Well, Rock's mama had another candidate in mind, one with good name recognition, zeal, and charm, eager, too, to sound alarms concerning Swamptown's true condition. Crocodile was her name, and conservation was her game. Yes, indeed, thought Crocomama, shifting her great thighs, a savvy gal with grassroots base could give old Crockefeller's boy an awesome race. The muddy crocs did finally arrive, treading on each other's tails, reeling from exhaustion in a kind of blind elation like robotic creatures well-prepped for a mass indoctrination. As Crocomama watched them clamber up into the bleachers and listened to the invocation recited by four Croco preachers, she told herself, come water high or water low, things'll have to change in Swamptown, yo. Left. Standing on the crowded dais, waiting for the multitudes to find their seats, Crocodile was surprised, the word shocked might be apter, to see the name of Rockadile, that cracker, on the list of speakers. She had heard rumors he might run, that he'd found a wealthy backer in the right-wing owner of the Crocodile Sun, key promoter-advertiser of ye old revival meeting, but she'd laughed it off. A croc who lazed all day, jaywalked, got hit by trucks, had clearly no sense of survival, in fact, might make a perfect rival. But heck, who'd want for senator a crocodile who'd been engaged, or so she'd heard, to that licentious alligator bird, who gave up scepter, grail, and pick for her, and then got jilted. No, it was too sick. Yet here his name was, on the list. Crocodile sighed. Hers would be a lonely fight against big money, greed, the power of the right-wing tabloids to mislead. A Senate race was no great pleasure, no free ride. To advertise her cause, she'd need the treasure of a dozen sunken wrecks, or, failing that, at each low tide, would have to walk along the shore and rake the dunes to locate cast-up caches of doubloons. What gave her courage was her strong belief that every Croco son and daughter had the right to eat live crayfish in clean water, and that government, supposedly the voter's friend, ought to spend tax money to that end. Crocodile looked up at the crowd. They were a sight, those muddy creatures spreading outward through the bleachers, that squirming sea of leather programmed to obey old Crockefeller and his preachers, real or lay. Then Crocodile turned, and from across the crowded stage, by chance did intercept the gaze of two eyes which, when they found hers, did melt and mist with an emotion resembling an intense devotion. Crocodile? Could that stunning, mud-free croc across the platform be the worthless Rock? And if so, was he running for the very Senate seat as she? Because a candidate with eyes so full of rapture and that, oh, so charismatic smile, might hope to capture any vote or heart that he went after, Republican or Demodile. Misgivings. When Crocomama saw the loving look that passed between her son and Dolly, a lump came to her throat. How fast they grew up. Seems like yesterday she'd held her baby in her jaws to keep him safe from predators. And now her son had suddenly been snapped up by that trap called love. How the world was changing. In her day, mating was a chance encounter with some stranger, such as Rocky's unknown pa. But today, love was the thing. When possible, there even was a ring, a golden band like one she'd seen on that licentious alligator bird, who obviously hadn't heard that bird and croc, who some say shared Jurassic stock, today can't get it on together. Nor did that finely feathered hussy seem to know which was a croc and which a gator. Just her good luck, none took her for a flying fish and ate her. Her Rock in love, she had to smile. Dolly was a demodile with brains and lovely leather. A croc with truer heart and mind Rocky couldn't hope to find. Voting over, she and he would go to Washington together, Madam Senator from Yo, and he her mate. Then Crocomama looked below at the tangled gray tableau and wondered just which reptile had been chosen for the crocopotty slate. So many muddy critters filled the dais it was hard to tell just who was who, much less their bias. And then she saw old Crockefeller, front row center in the bleachers, his eely features, especially that yellow grin, were stretched so wide with vile enjoyment, half the crocodentists in the county might therein have found employment. But then, oh no, a chummy look had passed between her son and that old crook, and this was when she knew beyond a doubt her son had no idea what honesty was all about. "My rock," she sighed, "is most peculiarly allied. I wouldn't even be surprised to learn he's running on the crocopotty ticket for the Senate seat from Yo. And if that's so, I'd almost rather he had never woken from his coma or had croaked a long, long time ago." Just then a crocospeaker rose, and with his feet did pound so hard upon the boards, entreating the God-fearing hordes to come to order and find seating, so that he could begin the meeting, that they actually heeded, got as quiet as crocs waiting under water for some prey to seize. And so a kind of holy silence gripped that mob of brutish giants, till no cough or belch or sneeze did interrupt the speaker's greeting, or intrude upon his reading from a booklet of misleading Crockefeller sophistries. The First Debate. It took the best part of 8 hours for the prelims to abate, and all this while the crowd did feed on hot dogs of assorted breeds, both local and imported. Some came from Crockefeller farms and stables, meat as fine as ever graced the tables of a Julia Child or Cunard line. And while they ate, they quenched their thirst on gator juice from fresh-squeezed alligators who, once flayed, were diced and canned, their well-tanned skins then put in special bins. They drank and drank and ate and ate. The sky grew dark, the hour late. But finally the moment came that all awaited, the one-on-one debate by opposition candidates. Rockadile and Crocodile, squinting in the spotlight, stared at by 800 eyes, took their places on the dais. Then a well-known, well-liked, very vocal croco-yokel took the mic and posed the question, "Should all taxes be both privatized and local?" "Repealed," 400 croco voters squealed. But Rock jumped forward. "No," he pleaded, "certain revenues are needed to subsidize big corporations and pay for lobbyists, concrete and bio-dredging. What we Republicans are pledging is to spend your money on necessities like these, not let D.C. decide what folks in Swamptown need." Then, foot on heart, young Rocky swore, "Come water high or water low, when I to Washington do go, I'll introduce a bill that every cent a resident of Yo is taxed on profits and on labor, won't leave our state, but will be paid to Crockefeller, our good neighbor, a croc who doesn't have to guess just who owes how much tax, or his or her address." Then, having sworn this, Rock did turn and sent his burning gaze toward Crocodile for her approbation and applause. But she'd already seen the flaws in Rocky's reasoning and quickly took the floor. "We crocs are anyway too poor," she pointed out, "to fall into a bracket that the IRS can tax. With Rocky's bill, the only one who will be freed of federal taxation, taxes that could help preserve ecology throughout the nation, is old Crockefeller, a croc already rich as rich can be. And why is he so rich? Because he taxes us on water found in every bog and ditch, water which, in fact, does not belong to him. I say this water should be free to each and every croc." And then, her minute done, and feeling she had won, she yielded to the clock. Young Rocky was amazed. He had no doubt her words were true, and suddenly Rock felt he knew what politics was all about, to separate from one another lover, brother, sister, mother, not bring them all together in some fine cause or endeavor. Well, there seemed no point in speechifying half the night until each croc collapsed from poppycock or too much dinner. Crocodile clearly was the winner. He'd argued true, but her words made more sense. And now the only thing to do was bow to Dolly's eloquence. "Congratulations," Rocky told her with a smile. "You won with elegance and style," and he held out his foot. But when her lovely foot touched his, an overpowering emotion like a wave out of the ocean engulfed young Rock from tail to snout. And all that kept the youth from passing out was one big lusty cheer for her, his dear, his crocodile, followed by applause that seemed to sanction his surrender to a love sublime and tender. And then young Rocky sent a happy grin out toward his backer, but through the spotlight's glare he saw the bleacher seat was bare. Wherever Crockefeller was, he wasn't there. Spin Town. Where had he gone? It seems old Crockefeller had run to the newsroom of his crocodile son to set the headlines of tomorrow's first edition. Rocky won, the headline shouted. Demodile confused. He laughed, amused by his own composition. This story'll get things spinning. And then he wrote an editorial about Rock's winning. When Swamptown crocodiles awoke the morning after the debate and saw the headlines in the sun, they thought it great that somewhere someone set the record straight. We're not too smart, they opined as they made their muddy beds. Last night that gator juice went to our heads. Without the sun and what somebody wrote, each one of us would waste his precious vote. When Crocamama saw the sun, she couldn't help but feel a flash of pride to read her boy had won. But it was brief, for then her anger and her indignation rose. Who does old Crocaviller think he is to feed us lies like those? No croc attending that debate, no matter how much juice he drank or canine ate, could fail to note the crocodile earned his vote. And so she went to see the loser, to, if need be, disabuse her of all feelings of rejection caused by someone's cunning bid to micromanage the election. The surf was gray, the mermaids singing each to each. She found poor Crocodile walking on the beach, dejected and alone, scratching at each dune and stone, but finding few doubloons for all her trying. Dolly read the sun, and there was no denying she was up against the tough political machine, operated by a croc as mean could be. But Dolly, Crocamama said, my Rocky just adores you. He'd as soon be dead as let you go or let you lose. Don't bet on it, said Dolly. If Rocky had to choose between that bird and me, the Senate, and his dad. His dad, cried Crocamama, who would that be? But Crocodile shut her snout. If Crocamama hadn't heard the gossip bruited all about, how could she ever tell her Rocky's dad was said to be old Crocafeller? But Crocodile's silence seemed to scream the unsaid truth. Suddenly the name of her ex-lover hit poor Crocamama like a manhole cover rolling 40 miles an hour. And though she felt that something in her died, which may have been her pride, she opted to make no response, at least not for the nonce. Song of the Mermaids. What were the mermaids singing? Songs of love, of course, and warnings of rough seas and dangerous rocks. They sang of love between two star-crossed crocs, for they could see, as ungrammatical as it might be, that she loved him as much as he loved she. But there were dangers for the two, reptiles who had far too much at stake in things political to care how far they went or be self-critical about which rules they bent. The mermaids sang of love, of rocky coasts, of death and dying. And was that sea spray on their cheeks, or were they crying? A Butterfly in Peking. Two more big debates did follow, and all agreed that Crocodile'd won, until they read the morning sun. This was frustrating for Dolly. Her dire warnings and expoundings on the state of their surroundings were for naught. Swamptown crocs quite simply bought whatever nonsense Crocafeller wrote, and what was worse, he had Rocky in his purse. What could she do to separate those two? Perhaps put out the word that till the sun did shine a probing beam on Swamptown muck, she'd have no further truck with Rocky. So she did it, though it broke her heart to shut him out, because she loved that roc, a croc as dear could be, a croc so shy he'd not yet dared approach her off the stump, much less declare his love, the silly chump. Well, it might work, and anyway a gentle nudge could do no harm, just sound a very faint alarm. not cause the world to go berserk. When Rocky heard his dearest treasure looked upon him with displeasure, he hurried straight to Crockefeller. "Dad," he said, "I'm too in love with Dolly to continue to oppose her. I and everyone who knows her find her reasoning well-grounded, all her arguments well-founded, her expoundings well-expounded, and everything expressed with style and grace. In short, I'd like to quit the race." Rockefeller was astounded. His son in love with Crocodolly? Could Rock's recent melancholy, his lackluster conduct in debate, plus his strange predisposition to capitulate, result from love of one he ought to hate? "But boy, you're doing great. You've won each contest, every single one. You must have read that in the Sun. Hey, voting's just a week away. The ballot's printed. Promise Dad you'll be there with him, nothing stinted, on election day." Well, thought Rocky, 1 week's not a big concession. Once the polls have closed, no matter which of us has won, I'll pop the question. "Okay, Dad," he told him, after pondering a minute. "If you want me to, I'll run. But my heart's not in it." Thomas Confrontation. "I'm playing patriarch today," grinned Rockefeller, noting who was climbing up his hillock. "Come on," he called, "and take a load off. Rest your tush." But Crockamama, scorning his false greeting, said she hadn't come to beat around the bush. "If you think Rock's your blood relation, you should honor him enough to set him free of filial and feudal obligation. Let him wed in peace and work with her to keep our species viable. I'm sure that even you must see that you and he now disagree on every subject of debate." "Old gal, you're certifiable," laughed aloud the evil Croc. "Don't worry about Rock. I'll see the boy obeys his paw." Crockamama set her jaw. "We Demodiles intend to win. Republicans will take it on the chin unless they smarten up real fast." But then she paused, aghast, to see he wore a golden band around one tooth, the very ring her son had given to that bird, whom, incidentally, none had seen or heard in weeks. What did it mean? An avian donation to a right-wing crocodile boss, or sloppy flossing following a snack? "I'm off now," Crockamama said, "and won't be back. But listen to the words of she who soon will be your daughter, and do what any decent news croc oughter. Direct the sun's bright beams to probe what's rotten in the state of Yo." "Like in your dreams," old Crockefeller growled. "Now do us both a favor, you sententious cow, and go." The Cellar. Below the grassy surface of a hillock, in a dark and dankish crayfish cellar, stood a cage with one bird in it. Minute after boring minute, hour after day, she watched the crayfish vats and wondered why fish looked as odd as they, and why they called them cray. "It comes from Middle French crevice," an elderly acquaintance in the corner told her, "though French is not my field of expertise." Then, getting bolder, he went on, "But tell me why you call yourself an alligator bird, a name I've never heard." Replied the bird, "It's a question of poetic meter. Alligator bird sounds neater than crocodile bird, a.k.a. African plover, which is what I really am, my species no doubt smuggled over. But that name, like the one my mother gave me, is poetically unscannable. And what might that name be?" "She called me Annabelle, Annabelle Lee, a bunch of syllables and stresses useless to an honest poet." "How well I know it," sighed the man, "and how often I've despaired at having my name and addresses, Ph.D. and M.S.'s, poetically impaired. My name, you see, is J.A. Prufrock, and I'm a homeless ornithologist." At this, the alligator bird, tipping one eye toward the corner, asked him was he sleeping there on Gunny 'cause he'd lost his job and money? "Just so," said he. "As winged species go extinct, there's less work for the likes of me, whose specialty is birdies having vital signs. When pulse and breathing go away, I find I've nothing more to say. It's at such times an honest ornithologist resigns." The captive bird let out a sigh. "It's good to hear that somewhere out there honesty's alive and kicking. The evil croc who put me in this cage deserves a licking." Dr. Prufrock could not believe his ears. "You say a croc is holding you? A crocodile? a beast that lives 100 years, that grows 9 meters long, and has a jaw so strong and big that it can down a full-sized pig?" "That's right," the bird replied. "That's Crockefeller to a T. A croc as mean can be, and big as he is mean." Then, panicked by immortal dread, J.A. Prufrock said, "I better leave before I'm seen." But it already was too late to latch on to a different fate. In minutes he was found and drowned and served up on a dinner plate. And with his vital signs away, he found he had no more to say. And though he wanted to resign, they washed him down with Beaujolais. A Crocposition. Next to Crockefeller on his hillock stood a cage with one bird in it. Minute after minute, with utter disregard, the aged reptile let escape a sulphurous petard. Ha! That bloody feed had been exactly what he'd needed to concentrate his mind on future deeds, deeds as gory and perverse as ever did enslime the lining of a coffin or a hearse, deeds to foment dread and cause some dead among the opposition, all without the least blame or suspicion falling on his head. Then, turning to the bird, he said, "Now listen up, for here's a proposition that you can't refuse if ever you expect to lose this cage and fly off free." And she, of course, did listen, for the air and breeze were clear and bright, and sunlight glistened on a zillion birds and gators, crocs and frogs cavorting in the muddy bogs. Indeed, this chance to fly away provoked such yearning that her heart was burning with suspense to hear what he would say. And then he told her that she'd play the role of messenger between two lovers, like that friar and that nurse who once upon a time in far Verona helped turn love's sweet song into a curse. Then, scraping the gold band from off his tooth, he said, "Here, give her this, and she'll believe he sent you and assume you speak the truth." Jing Ide. Campaigns were drawing to a close. Election day was near. 3 dozen alligator birds, midnight volunteers, hopped from croc to sleeping croc and whispered, "Dolly," in their ears. This subliminal campaigning was a last-ditch effort and a desperate one to stop a criminal from claiming victory for his son. Rockadile, who didn't care who won or lost, couldn't wait for the election to be done with, wanted just to find his Dolly, lie out in the sun with her, and pop the question. He knew his father couldn't long resist his bride. He'd soon set right-wing politics aside, and then all three would go together to D.C. and live in simple harmony, making sure by making laws the crocs stayed off the interstate, avoided poachers' traps, found ways to resist drought. In short, ensure that crocs did not die out, for that's what life was all about. The week without his darling Dolly passed as slowly as a year, but when election eve arrived, Rock's spirits rose. Tomorrow, when the polls had closed, he'd go to Dolly and propose. The Betrayal. Election eve, old Crockefeller opened the cage door. "Fly straight and true," he told the alligator bird, "and when you get there, do exactly as I told you to, remembering the while that if you flee or try to trick me with your cunning or your guile, you'll never lunch again upon a sunning crocodile." She had a hunch he wasn't kidding, that she'd better do his bidding or she'd rue the day. So, hopping from the cage, she slipped the golden band upon her foot and flew away. It was already growing dark when she found Crocodile in a pond within a park watching children play. She hadn't come there to aggress them, pull them under, or ingest them. She yearned only to caress them, for she had no babies of her own. The alligator bird flew down and perched on Crocodile's head. "I've brought a message from a friend," she said, "who wants to meet you right away." And then she paused, because it wasn't easy to betray another creature, even her, that very croc, who'd made her own romance with Rock a jealous mockery. Crocodile's heart beat fast. If the bird spoke true, at last she'd be together with her love. But wasn't this the very bird she'd heard had made a contribution to the right-wing COP? "Some say I did," the alligator bird agreed, "but don't be miffed. I swear it was no gift." You see, one day I lost a golden band the Rockefeller found upon the sand. He gave it to his son, who's given it to me, to give to you by way of proof that what I'm saying is the truth. And taking off the ring, she held it out beyond the end of Dolly's snout. I trust you, Crocodile said. Where does he want to meet? In that same bog, the bird replied, where one fine day a Cessna fell from high above and landed at your feet, the day he fell in love. Her words were gracious and disarming, but at the same time quite alarming, for since that day a holy lot of humans seeking souvenirs had visited that spot, and once those piggish tourists made it ecologically degraded, poachers came and set out traps and snares. If Rocky went there unawares, he might be trapped or shot. I'd better warn him, Dolly said. Then slipping the gold band upon her tooth, she thanked the alligator bird and hurried off. For what I've done, the bird lamented, there are no words. And then she saw, as if presented in a dream, a flock of alligator birds alighting on the backs of dozing crocs. How strange! For next she seemed to hear the name of Dolly, floating like a ghostly mist upon the moonlit scene. And if this was an omen, what did the omen mean? Election day dawned warm and drear. High voter turnout was expected, though some had become disaffected by the dirty politicking. Even before 7:30, crocs from every part of Yo, several screaming and some kicking, trickled into downtown Swamptown. There they learned the way to indicate their choice was not by ballot, but by voice. Votes were bellowed and the decibels were tallied. At first Rock seemed to be ahead, then Crocodile rallied. And that was fine. Yet Rock was worried. Eager to see Dolly, he had hurried into town that morning. When by noon she hadn't come, he wondered why. Where could she be? Suddenly a bird lit on his head. Rocky, the bird said, it's me, your former friend. I've come to tell you. But the bird could not continue, could not say what Rockefeller told her to relate, that Dolly wanted nevermore to see him and had left the state. She knew that Rock would hate her for the part she'd played, but now, unable to keep lying, she blurted out, "Oh, Rocky, Crocodile is dying." "Where is she?" Rocky cried. And so she told him, knowing that if Crocodile died, no creature of the earth or sky above would ever again win his trust or love. Dolly. Without a moment's hesitation, Rock turned and disappeared into the vegetation. The alligator bird flew overhead, relating all the deeds that led up to this tragedy, but Rocky hardly heeded what she said. Wary of the hidden traps as he approached the fatal bog, Rockodile picked up a log and held it out between his jaws to set them off and clear the way. And so he rapidly advanced until the bird, who had a better view, said softly, "There she is." And then he saw her too, half hidden in some reeds, one leg taken in a trap. Rockodile approached her gently. "Oh, Dolly," Rocky said, "I have to save you. If I can't, I'll never leave you." "I believe you," Crocodile told him, wishing she could kiss and hold him. "Rock, I love you, but beware. There are poachers everywhere. You, a senator from Yo, will do a lot of good for crocs throughout the state, but if you don't go soon, it soon may be too late." But Rocky was indifferent to his fate. Her life was far more threatened than his own. He saw that even if his mighty jaws could separate the claws of steel that gripped her leg, it would cause her greater pain. Her life hung by a thread, and it was plain to both of them he could not save her. "Oh, do not die," Rock would have said, could he have paraphrased John Donne, "for I shall hate all living creatures so when thou art gone that thee I shall not celebrate when I remember thou wast one." But what he did say was, "Oh, Dolly, if you die, then soon or late I'll kill the reptiles who have brought you to this fate. Were I to live 100 years, how could I legislate with a heart so full of hate?" And then he gently placed his length beside her, close as close could be, so she'd absorb his love and energy. Just then a shout was heard. "Ecologists are coming," cried the alligator bird, "the same you met after your coma." A desperate hope seized Rock. "They'll take you to a vet," he said. But Dolly knew before the sun had set she would be dead. "Don't let them touch me, Rock. I'd rather die with you beside me in this bog than with the kindest strangers, be they conservationists or rangers." Her words did break his heart, but Rocky understood. So as the people came their way, he raised his head and bellowed out a warning. "Hey, look," one cried, "that female croc is in a trap, and that big male is trying to protect her. She'll die unless we find a way to make him leave so we can save her." Just then a man appeared, a lethal weapon on his shoulder. "Great, I trapped one," he rejoiced. "These crocodiles are getting bolder. Some days ago a small plane landed in this bog, and reptiles just like those ate pilot, passenger, and dog. You say that male's protecting her? Let's see if Super Croc moves faster than a speeding bullet." And so saying, raised his AK-47, aimed and fired. In the din that followed, 40 rounds pierced Dolly's side, and she expired. But before the sound had faded, he had found that men do better on dry ground than under water, where a power greater than a locomotive brought him in a single bound. "I hope they get the sucker," was his final thought before he drowned. Aftermath. Waiting in his newsroom for his plan to hatch, old Crockefeller came across a worrisome dispatch. 2 deaths had just occurred within that bog where he had set his plot, and then came word one candidate was shot, the other on the run. And suddenly his son was in the limelight, rumored to be carrying a gun and ordered shot on sight. And next he heard from a snitchy stringer bird that Rocky had been told about his role in Crocodile's death and had sworn to get him. "Does he think I'll bloody let him?" Crockefeller snarled. "Just because my son's prodigious whip of tail and snap of jaw have caused that whippersnapper to be hunted by the law does not imply he's any threat to his well-bodyguarded paw." Then, having put a contract out on Rocky's feathered friend, Crockefeller hurried downtown, where he found the voting not yet at an end. For though the voters knew one candidate was dead and one had fled, in what a New York newspaper would incorrectly call a stunning dual defection, what no one knew was what to do to stop the damned election. Then Crockefeller said, "Upon reflection, I feel that I can help you through this sorry situation. Make me your senator from Yo, and off to Washington I'll go to write new legislation that will benefit our state." And so they gave him every vote, despite the screams of one despairing Crocomom, who told him where he ought to go, and not just in his dreams. Last, beside each bog and ditch, the blast of rifle shots resounded. Crocs that looked like crocodile, and many did to untrained eyes, were killed by strangers, guys with guns who felt they had a bona fide excuse to unloose firepower. Conservationists and rangers worked to stop them, and, about the twilight hour, calm descended on the land. Shortly after dark, Rock found Crocomama in the lake within the park, where Crocodile used to watch as children played. "It's here my Dolly was betrayed," he told her bitterly, and then, dry-eyed, related how she'd died. "Oh, Rock," she said, "it would help you if you cried." "I will not cry," said Crocodile. "Not yet, not yet." But Crocomama did, and when she'd done, she told him Crockefeller was en route to Washington to take the Senate seat that he or Dolly would have won. "Dad's history," said Rock. "I'm on my way." "Well, be real careful, son, and take these gold doubloons. They're still a little sandy, but will surely come in handy in a town like Washington." But Rock refused. Said he, "There's nothing gold can buy that teeth and will as strong as mine cannot obtain." "Except," she smiled, "a ticket for the train." So he accepted one doubloon with some chagrin, then chucked her on the chin and kissed her snout, 'cause that's what moms were all about. Crockefeller in D.C. When Horatio Crockefeller slithered from the train, he heard tremendous cheers. He hadn't been to Washington in over 80 years, yet was a legend in the place, a lobbyist, a donor. To politicians of the right, kingmaker and dethroner. So when he left the train that night, he found a city of delight. The mall was filled with gold balloons that shone as brightly as doubloons, while marching bands with big bassoons played stirring patriotic tunes. And this was all for him, the senator-elect who'd staged an upset victory to give his grateful party a congressional majority. Old Crockefeller grinned. How different from his first time in this town. Back then he was a yokel from a backwater called Yo, who didn't even know, when staying at a Washington hotel, One didn't eat to the desk clerk, or his bell, or the bellhop, for that matter. Nor could this callow youth have guessed a hotel might express extreme displeasure, even threaten him, a guest, with criminal arrest, like any common felon, were he to eat the waiter after ordering a melon. Well, since those days, he'd opted to remain behind the scenes, and in the century's late teens concealed his greed, intentions, and ambition while supporting women in their fight for prohibition. This artfully successful, constitution-changing ruse earned him fortunes in the 20s through the sale of bootleg booze. In the 30s, auctioneering helped him buy up bankrupt farms, while his post-war profiteering was black market surplus arms. No one in the 50s gave more money to the Klan. In the 60s, Rockefeller was the croc they called the man. In the next two decades, takeovers and mergers were his thing, while the 90s found him dealing in hard drugs and publishing. It seemed quite fitting to him, then, to come to Washington again to start a new endeavor on the eve of the millennium. "So say goodbye to bogs and dunes," said Rockefeller to his goons. Then he, with local croco mobsters, through the weeest morning hours, quaffed champagne, smoked big cigars, and dined on caviar and lobsters. On the Train. All through the endless hours on the train, Rock couldn't sleep. Again, 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 a dark reptilian force like some rough beast from out an ancient lair revisited the awful actions of that day, and with its nails did etch deep in his soul a track that led to vengeance, not despair. As for the moments in between those hellish crossings, marked by turnings and by tossings into memories obscene, Rock lay as still and dim as some uprooted tree trunk, log, or limb. The roar and oscillations of the train made mind and body numb, while Crocodile's image in his brain was like a small, bright sun inside a universe of pain. Her musky scent, a sweet refrain that kept the song of her alive, played on. No other scent would ever in him work that miracle to turn a blood so cold to fire, make whole marshes redolent of Crocodile and desire. On Rocky's back perched one who shared in petite parallel his heartbreak and his ire. It was that alligator bird, another victim of the fate stage-managed by a croc who didn't hesitate to murder and manipulate. She felt her life and self-respect had both been wrecked by happenings beyond her comprehension or her power to affect. So she had sworn, no matter what the risk, to stay by Rocky's head, give help and never run, until the foe was dead, the victory was won. Crocodile in D.C. Rock arrived in Washington at dawn, and it was clear a party had been going on. Large tents still stood upon the mall, and strewn about the monuments to well-loved former presidents were soda cans and fast food wrappers. Meditating hundred-lappers ran around a tidal pool where Rocky stopped to take a dip. Just then he heard a cheerful cry and saw some men go jogging by. One wore a smile of good intent, and yes, it was the president. Seeing him was such a thrill that then and there did Rocky swear, "Come water high or water low, if I this nightmare do survive and somehow live to 35, I'll run for U.S. president, my platform, the environment. Thus Dolly's message will live on, and that will be her monument." "You ought to find a sauna," said some stranger standing near. "That's where the other crocs all go to warm their blood and rub their snouts with top politicos from out the 50 states and yo. Now if you wonder how I know..." "Oh, let me guess," broke in the alligator bird. "You are a herpetologist." "Just so," replied the man, impressed. "My name is Best, and I am usually addressed by those who know as Dr. Best. But here I think we have digressed. You see, since yo became a state, thanks to the thousands of doubloons a certain reptile did donate to some key legislative races, throughout D.C. there's been a spate of truly down-home crocofaces, which to me has been a boon." "But you look starved," said Dr. Best, "and there are rivers all about." Said Rock, "I don't need frogs or trout. Enough is on my plate to sate a dozen crocs like me." Then, stepping from the pool, he quickly found the scent of Rockefeller near a tent, and followed it to a hotel, approached the desk, and rang the bell. When Crockefeller heard that Crock and Bird were asking for him at reception, he sent down word that he was resting, but would meet them at the mouth of Rock Creek Park in the hour before dark, adding they should come alone. "It doesn't matter," Rock assured the alligator Bird, beside herself with apprehension. "Since I alone can fight my fight, it might as well be fought tonight." Then he, to ease her tension, used the change from his doubloon to buy some food and rent a private sauna room. And there they stayed the long day through, waiting for the rendezvous. Showdown at Rock Creek. An hour before dark, at the mouth of Rock Creek Park, five crocodiles did meet in a 4-to-1 croc distribution. An alligator Bird was also there, scared but filled with resolution. She'd already made a flight around the park to see, before the fall of night, what she could see. She saw a playground and a zoo, a bridle path and stable, too, and now was perched up in a tree. Said Crockefeller to his limo driver, "Come and get us in an hour, but while you're gone, restock your bar with 50 pounds of caviar, a dozen magnums of champagne, and several buckets of chow mein." And then he turned to Rockadile. "You seem to think," the old croc said, "that you're a threat upon my life. If this continues, I'll see to it you and your bird friend do rue it." But when their eyes met, Rocky saw his struggle now was with a force much greater than his paw. It was a struggle in himself with something he had never had to face before, an ancient, archetypical taboo passed down through blood into the dark subconscious of a vast collective mind. It said, "A crocodile must never kill another of its kind." And it was plain as plain could be the only vertebrate on earth that did this act that every other species did abhor, that regularly killed its kind in private and in war, and even celebrated this in poetry and lore, was man. "I think you'll find," Rock said, "that I have other plans to deal with you." His father smiled. "And may I ask what those plans are?" Said Rock, "I'll drive you off so far from all your seats of power and great wealth, which were amassed through murder, lies, and stealth, that none will ever hear of you again. Although I swear, if killing you would bring my Dolly back to me, I wouldn't hesitate to put away my honor and my pride and break the strongest taboo of them all, the one called patricide." "Strong words," sneered Crockefeller. "Don't forget, my son, to get at me you'll have to fight not one but three, and I do prophesy that they will shrug off every punch and clean your clock and eat your lunch and hang you out to dry, and when they're done, I'll print your obit in the Sun." One thing was certain. All three crocs in question were the most redoubtable that Rock had ever seen. Their jaws were cruel, their eyes were mean, their leather tough. From snout to tail they were the stuff of which bad dreams are made. Yet Rockadile was unafraid. He'd suffered far too much, and felt he had already lost more than his life was worth, his joy in sky and sea and earth, to fear to die. And so Rock faced the three and told them honestly, "To stop me you will have to kill me, but I warn you, it will not be easy. Make my day and try." On hearing this, the goons looked shocked and took young Rockadile aside. "Us kill you? Don't you know that since 10 million years ago we crocs have had a rule against the killing of our kind? If while we were protecting him, we were obliged to butcher you, we'd surely break that old taboo, and that's one thing we'd never do." Thought Rock, "I truly fear, despite their honorable words, these crocs are insincere. For aren't these three the same who at ye old revival meeting squeezed those gaiters till they cried, then flayed their skins before they died to put in special bins?" "So, Rock," they said, "don't worry about us. Do your darndest to the guy and be our guest. We three feel blessed that we can leave him here with you while we head home, for, though we never let it show, we miss our wives and kids in yo." Then off they went, but just as soon as they were out of sight, they climbed into a limousine and sped off in the night, because, it seems, the three were in the pay of mafiosi who had told them to betray their croco boss in a classic double cross. "I hear you fellows played old Crockefeller's curtain song like virtuosi," they were told by one old crocodon reclining with dark glasses on. "When Rockadile starts in with him, he'll wish that he was dead and gone." And then he smiled at his three hick town goons and promised them enough doubloons to make them wildly rich. And then he bade his chauffeur take a turnoff down a road along a ditch where they were bound with tape from tail to nape. And when they asked the reason why, his irrefutable reply was, "Life's a bitch, and then you die." At which the car door opened wide, and all three were propelled outside, and there for 2 long weeks they lay, and then were found and hauled away. When Crockefeller realized that the current distribution was a one-on-one, and one of these a mean old crock, and one his gallant, unforgiving son, he knew his time had come. "Get on with it," he said. "What will you have me do?" "We'll walk a bit," said Rock. "I hear that there's a zoo." "A zoo?" the old crock cried with breaking voice. "I'll never go into a zoo. To be confined and on display is worse than being dead." But Crockefeller had no choice. With Rockadile behind him and the bird upon his head, they walked the long park through, and at the very minute that it opened, found the zoo. The directors were ecstatic when they saw the monster croc, a species that was lacking in their fine reptilian stock. "But I'm the senator from Yo," cried Crockefeller angrily. "If you dare lay a hand on me, I'll see you lose your subsidy." The directors hesitated, for if what he said was true, they could not put him in their zoo. Just then a herpetologist spoke up. "I understand your grave concern regarding this croc's claim," said he, "for to the untrained eye most croco faces look the same, especially a father and his son. But I will gladly certify the senator from Yo is Rocky Crockefeller and not Horatio." And so they led old Crockefeller off and put him in a kind of glass aquarium. In time he proved a popular display, and people came from miles away to stare at him. Next day Rock was seated on the left side of the aisle, for he had changed his party and become a demodile. The alligator bird, who'd slept over at the zoo, a guest of their bird resource center, had some babies with another plover who was housed there too. When their fledglings left the nest, she gave her mate a peck goodbye and flew to Rocky's side. Then this croc and alligator bird, who'd been through bitter times together, worked on Dolly's legacy with no let-up whatsoever. In May they called a croco march supporting eco-legislation. Reptiles came to Washington from every corner of the nation, though tallies of their numbers differed 10-1 between the Pulitzer Prize-winning Crocodile Sun and that conservative, infernal tabloid called the Wall Street Journal. 6 years went by, and Rock was reelected in a landslide. When he reached the age of 35, by then his father, Mom, and Bird had died, Rock ran for president and won, and 4 years later won again. By then he had inherited his father's wealth, with still a long, long time to live and millions of doubloons to give through numerous foundations, and since he had no daughter and no son, Rock became the world's first dynasty of one. Epilogue Part 2. As the century wore on, Rock saw with sorrow where the world was heading. Despite much trying, human populations everywhere were spreading, displaced creatures dying. In 2027, while politicians worldwide worried about re-election, the last surviving Bengal tiger, lacking habitat and looked on as a dangerous pest, took a bullet in the chest, after which her priceless skin was put into a special bin. In 2032, the last black rhino, born and raised inside a zoo, was murdered for his horn, which, powdered into finest dust, was stored in special tins and sold as aphrodisiacs to Nipponese insomniacs. In 2034, the two remaining forests, one in Argentina, one El Salvador, were burned so that a burger czar could raise some hay to graze his herds. Indeed, the cattle grazed so well that 2 years later, all that land where once did dwell tree nymphs and rarest birds was nothing more than sand, more sand, and cattle turds. In 2045, starving human populations coughing in the noxious air tried penetrating other nations. Those not shot by border guards learned to savor every edible they found, tree sloths, baboons, even maggots in the ground, which soon returned the favor. In 2048, global warming caused such floods and drought that half the continents were underwater, half dried out. Then, in 2053, in places like the Vineyard, Costa Rica, and Nepal, the last surviving native species lost their war with tourist feces. Epilogue, fin. So the years went by, and in 2085, old Rocky was the last remaining crocodile alive. One day, feeling that his time had come, he wrote an editorial for the final issue of The Sun. "We tried," he wrote, "we truly tried. Perhaps our efforts did, for one brief moment, help restrain the tide of muck and murk that has destroyed our world. I think we must concede, if we obtains, and anyone to read this column still remains, that many animals and mankind had a certain flaw. From a million years ago until, let's say, the year of 1925, this defect did appear to be a strength that probably evolved to help all creatures of a hostile world survive. But later it did aid the human race to grow and multiply and eat the whole wide world alive. The defect? Call it greed, self-interest, lust for power. The age of politics that it did breed was not our planet's finest hour." Then Rocky signed his name and went outside to watch the sun go down upon the old abandoned theme park where once jolly humans, dressed like dogs and mice, did romp. It was a place that formerly had been a swamp, with bogs and marshes deep and wet and scented with the musk of crocodile. Now the sun had set, and it was dusk, and those enchanted ponds a long, long time ago had dried. Then Rock lay down upon his hillock, and he cried.